Many critics believe this song called Rocket 88, recorded by Jackie Brenston in 1951, was one of the first rock and roll records, if not the first.
You women have heard of jalopies, you've heard the noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's straight, just one way. Everybody likes my Rocket 88. Baby, we'll ride in style, moving all along.
Jackie Brenston and many other African-American musicians like Chuck Berry or Bo Diddley were early pioneers of rock and roll. But rock and roll morphed into rock, which has come to be seen as a mostly white genre. In fact, in this interview in 1983, the late David Bowie challenged MTV to justify its lack of diversity in playing music videos.
I'm just floored by the fact that there's so few black artists featured on it. Why is that?
I think that we're trying to move in that direction. We want to play artists that seem to be doing music that fits into what we want to play for MTV. The company is thinking in terms of narrow casting.
That's evident. It's evident in the fact that the only few black artists that one does see are on about 2:30 in the morning or to around 6. Very few are featured predominantly during the day.
No, that's a...
I'll say that over the last couple of weeks these things have been changing, but it's a slow process.
I'm Sarah McConnell, and this is With Good Reason. Later in the show, how the integration of big league baseball led to the demise of the African-American baseball leagues. But first, by the 1960s, rock and roll music dropped the roll and became known just as rock. My first guest says along the way, rock has become less diverse. Jack Hamilton is a frequent contributor to Slate and a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. He's looking into how rock and roll music moved away from an interracial genre to one widely viewed as predominantly white. The title of your forthcoming book is Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll and the Racial Imagination. And this is sort of a book about something scholars are calling rockism, and this notion that rock and roll is thought of now as a very white-dominated genre, when of course it is such an amalgam of many, many influences.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things, the only black artist that you'll hear on a classic rock radio station with any regularity is Jimi Hendrix. You'll hear the Beatles all the time, you'll hear the Stones all the time, you'll hear Bob Dylan all the time, who were making music in the 1960s, but you're not hearing other African-American musicians from that period. These musicians are sort of left out of the sort of rock tradition. And in the 1960s, they were very much in that conversation. For instance, there's a cover story of Time magazine in 1965 that's called Rock and Roll, Everyone's Turned On, and the Supremes are on the cover. And the Supremes, you would never hear the Supremes on a classic rock radio station today. So you get, you know, the centrality of people like the Beatles and Bob Dylan. Then the Stones, it's, you know, later, I think someone like Bruce Springsteen. It's like, these are people who we just effortlessly understand as being rock music. By the time Jimi Hendrix died in 1970, people thought it was totally crazy that there was a black man playing electric lead guitar. Like, one of his obituaries refers to him as a, quote, black man in the alien world of rock. So he's being positioned almost literally as an outsider. No one thought it was strange when Chuck Berry was playing rock music or rock and roll music in, you know, 10 years earlier. Like, what happens? What accounts for that shift where Jimi Hendrix becomes the exceptional figure, you know, the only one, essentially?
Was Chuck Berry a lead guitarist in rock and roll music a decade earlier?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Chuck Berry is probably, I mean, I think he kind of invents the notion of rock guitar virtuosity. You know, you listen to the first opening seconds of Johnny B. Goode, you hear this torrent of notes coming out of a guitar. Just hear this torrent of notes, you know, this sort of, there's something flamboyantly virtuosic about what you're hearing there. I mean, that is kind of the invention of rock and roll lead guitar.
And who does he influence then?
Oh, I mean, it's really impossible to think of probably a guitar player after Chuck Berry who he hasn't influenced, but certainly Keith Richards would probably be one of the biggest. I mean, Jimi Hendrix certainly was definitely influenced by Chuck Berry. George Harrison from the Beatles. The Beatles, on their second album with the Beatles, they covered Roll Over Beethoven.
There's an entire chapter of your forthcoming book that is dedicated to Sam Cooke. Mm-hmm. Why do you see him as such an important figure in the lineage of rock and roll?
Sam Cooke is, I think, really one of the most fascinating American musicians of the 20th century. He was the first gospel singer to successfully cross over to the pop charts, and he did it with a song called You Send Me, which came out in 1958 and became a number one hit, still extremely famous song. We can listen to a little bit of it right here.
Darling, you send me, I know you. Honest you do, honest you do,
oh, you. This is not a piece of music that sounds like gospel music. This is a piece of music that sounds like basically a teenage love song from the late 1950s. In Sam Cooke's crossover, this was actually the market that he was really coveting. He makes a bunch of songs like Wonderful World, Only 16, Cupid. But Sam Cooke's pop output has often been seen as sort of lightweight and disposable by people. But in actuality, I think that what it's showing is that Sam Cooke was this incredibly versatile musician. A piece I'd really like to talk a little bit about is a song called The Change Is Gonna Come, which is probably Sam Cooke's most famous composition that he wrote in 1963, inspired by Bob Dylan's Blowin' in the Wind, which had come out that same year. I'll play a bit of A Change Is Gonna Come right now.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. It's been too hard.
Oh, isn't that great?
So there's a number of like just fantastic things about this recording, and one of which is Sam Cooke's voice, which is among the most beautiful ever heard on earth. But I mean, this is, you know, it goes on to be, it's very transparently a song about civil rights. I mean, this is a definitively avant-garde piece of music. There's no other piece of music prior to this that really sounded like it. It's Sam Cooke making this really, really powerful artistic and political statement.
Are you saying in some way Sam Cooke is as great as Bob Dylan?
Oh, absolutely.
But not as widely recognized.
No, certainly not. I mean, right now there are two full-length books out there about Sam Cooke. There's close to 300 full books out there written about Bob Dylan.
Did Sam Cooke admire Bob Dylan?
Absolutely. There's a story about when Sam Cooke first heard Blowin' in the Wind, him remarking to one of his close friends that he couldn't believe that, quote, a white boy had written a song like that. Absolutely. And Sam Cooke also performed Blowin' in the Wind in concert.
Why do critics sometimes think of Sam Cooke's music as something of a sellout and not being what rock music critics think of as really raw and genuine?
That's a great question, Sarah. I mean, I think a lot of it, again, has to do with the idea that, like, to make music for white audiences is to somehow dilute the power of one's music. There's no evidence that Sam Cooke saw his move into this as a compromise. Whereas someone like Bob Dylan, when he makes Like a Rolling Stone and makes his sort of explosion into rock stardom out of folk, Bob Dylan's never called a sellout. He was called a sellout by the folk revival. But rock fans don't see what Bob Dylan did as selling out. Rock fans see what Bob Dylan did as essentially inventing their conception of rock music.
So do you think that the musical influences from this era were kind of a one-way street where white musicians were springboarding off terrific pieces by African-American artists and going on to stardom?
No, I don't. I actually would not say that it was a one-way street at all. Like, I think that it's a real interracialism, I think, is the best way to think about it. The most important artist of the 1960s, white or black, would almost unquestionably be the Beatles. And the Beatles influenced everyone. One of my favorite instances of this is Stevie Wonder's cover of We Can Work It Out from 1970, which is a cover of a massively successful Beatles song from 1965, which was a huge hit for them, which probably many people know, but I'll play a little bit of the Beatles version for you right here.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work
it out. And this is it's a love song. It's a song about sort of the reconciliation of a relationship. And then 5 years afterwards, Stevie Wonder releases this cover version of it that really, I think, kind of transforms the song. And I'd love to play a little bit of that right now.
Think of what you're saying. You can get it wrong and still think that it's all right.
Hey,
think of what I'm saying.
Hey,
we can work it out and get it straight or say goodnight. We can work it out. We can work it out. Life is very short.
Okay, so there's just a number of remarkable things about this. I mean, first of all, it completely reimagines the song. It sounds completely different. It's really now become a dance song. But there's also something about his performance of it that it's really changed the meaning of the song. It stops feeling like it's a song being sung from a man to a woman, and it's starting to feel like it's more of this sort of broader call for kind of working it out, for kind of almost like a social reconciliation. Even just the way he sings the chorus, we can work it out, we can work it out. It's this sort of encouragement, whereas the Beatles version is more, we can work it out, we can work it out. It's a great testament to, you know, a great artist taking a great work by another great artist and hearing something totally new in it.
Is Stevie Wonder still played on rock and roll stations a lot?
Stevie Wonder, you certainly would not hear on a rock station. I mean, you would hear Stevie Wonder. I mean, he's played on, what would be called oldies stations, which is sort of interesting. You know, who gets, again, going back to the notion of sort of African-American music being seen as sort of old, as source material. This sort of, a lot of these artists are now being, are now really the way you hear them is on oldies stations.
And the Stones, of course, are up there with the Beatles in terms of, you know, icons of the rock and roll era, still heard and heard a lot and revered.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Rolling Stones in a lot of ways are probably the most racially controversial rock band of all time. The Rolling Stones' influences are unabashedly obsessed with African-American music, but have also been, you know, accused of theft or cultural appropriation. Jagger has been historically accused of being a minstrel show performer by certain people. And part of this is the Rolling Stones' own doing. They've courted these kind of controversies. In fact, a song I would love to play is one of the most famous Rolling Stones songs, and maybe one of the most controversial rock songs ever written, is the Rolling Stones' Brown Sugar from 1971. That's a song probably most people have heard, and a lot of people have probably danced to. It was a huge hit when it came out in 1971, but a lot of people maybe don't know the lyrics to that song, and I'll just repeat them because I know them from memory. So the opening lines of Brown Sugar are, Gold Coast slave ship bound for cotton fields, sold in a market down in New Orleans, scarred old slaver knows he's doing all right, hear him whip the women just around midnight.
Oh my gosh, I've never realized that. I've only heard Brown Sugar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's very hard to hear what Mick Jagger is actually saying in this, which is maybe deliberate because the lyrical content is kind of outrageous and incendiary. I mean, the Brown Sugar is basically, it's a song explicitly about slavery, and it's actually a song really more explicitly about the rape of a slave and about sexual violence and slavery, and really a song about just violence in general. But I think it's doing something more interesting also than simply maybe exploiting it. I think that there is actually like an engagement with history that's happening in this song that, while, you know, incredibly troubling, is also really pulling back the curtain on something. You know, this is something that's like, in a way, this is like one of the most honest songs. There aren't very many songs in American popular music that are about slavery. Like, who would write a pop song about slavery? And yet at the same time, underlying this song are so many issues that are actually pretty central to American popular music. You know, the intertwining of race and music, about of music and sex and injustice. But in the 1990s, Mick Jagger was giving an interview and he was asked about this song. Could you ever imagine yourself writing a song like that today? And he said, absolutely not. He said, you know, I don't know what possessed me. I don't know where I was at in this period that caused me to write those lyrics.
There is something called rockism that maybe gets at pretty much all of what we're talking about now, why we're not hearing extraordinarily gifted and popular African-American singers and performers from the 60s now on these rock and roll stations today.
Yeah, the big debate is between what's called rockism and what's come to be called poptimism. And rockism is a critical ideology that holds up rock music as being kind of the most serious and worthy form of popular music. So it compares everything to, you know, Dylan or the Beatles or the Stones or Springsteen, and usually finds everything that's not rock music to be kind of lacking. So, I mean, a great example would be like the disco sucks movement of the 1970s was definitively a rock. I mean, that was rock fans who were mostly saying that. The disparaging of hip hop music as being not real music in the 1980s, or, you know, even to this day, like the way that someone like Taylor Swift is not taken particularly seriously by certain people. I mean, what's rock and what's poppy? There's no more poppy music that's ever been made than the Beatles. The right. Beatles are the most successful pop band ever. And like, you know, and that should be something that is celebrated. Like, it's like that is something that's what makes the Beatles great. So, yeah. So I would say that, no, I don't think that it's really it has nearly as much to do with what stuff actually sounds like than people would like to convince you that it does.
Rockism will die.
Yeah, I think rockism is actually dying at the moment, but it was very, very influential for a very long period of time.
Jack Hamilton, thank you for talking with me today on With Good Reason.
Thanks so much for having me, Sarah. I had a great time.
Jack Hamilton is a professor of media studies at the University of Virginia. His forthcoming book is Just Around Midnight, Rock and Roll in the Racial Imagination. Coming up next, baseball and integration.